Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
8:04 on the score. I got Mullen Hanley. We got Mark Grody sitting in for Mike today. And you heard the voices of some of the great young Sox players, Nicky Delmonico, Tim Anderson, Matt Davidson. And we're heading out to the hotline where we find our buddy Scott Merkin. Let's face it, the North Star of the Merkin Media Galaxy. He covers the Chicago White Sox for MLB.com. Good morning, Scott. How are you doing?
How are you guys doing this morning?
Doing well, and always enjoying your coverage of the White Sox, and still love this idea that don't talk about rebuild, that's over. At least if you talk to the players on that roster, they believe that to be the case.
Yeah, you know, I think no team, even if a team, you know, let's take as an example the Marlins, who are not, you know, expected to do much this year, but no team ever goes into a season saying, well, yeah, we hope we win 70, you know, have a good time. But you get a sense the Sox with this group really believe that they could, you know, do something a little different this year. Now, I don't know if they think they're going to overtake the Indians or the Twins or the Yankees or the Red Sox, but they feel like this is a competitive group, and if nothing else, the start of something, you know, really special with this whole talent pool here.
Scott, I have been mocked and radio bullied this morning and beaten about physically.
Tell them why.
Yeah.
Just in general or
well, just it's another day at the office.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. There's a lot of abuse that goes on around here. For saying, Scott, that I think that the White Sox, because the lights are off, because they're properly motivated, because they've been told that they're going to lose, Ricky's boys don't quit, that the White Sox could be a 500 team this year. Do you think I'm crazy?
No, I think that definitely could happen. I think for that to happen, they would need to, you know, have a good start, obviously, and then carry it out for a little bit. I will say this. Rick Hahn has been consistent with his target in that, you know, they're not looking to get a wild card this year. They're looking to contend for multiple championships. So, you know, if come July the team is 7 or 8 over and maybe like 3 games out of a wild card, don't look for Rick to start, you know, turning things over to try and sneak into the playoffs for that one appearance. But with that said, I think if, you know, some of these younger guys make the maybe even a little bigger than expected jump, someone like Moncada, Giolito, Lopez, maybe even Fulmer, and then you're going to get assistance most likely from Kopech coming up during the year, Rodon coming back from injury, possibly Eloy Jimenez. You have the makings of what could be, you know, a decently competitive team this year, even in a year that, you know, if you talk to the White Sox probably privately, is not designated as a contention year as part of the rebuild.
But is it designated a year where they still want a high draft pick? I mean, are they going to keep guys down, not just because of the MLB clock ticking on contracts and control, but are they going to at least, you know, be aggressive in trying to get a top 10 draft pick, or are they just going to let it play out the way it plays out?
It's different from last year. Last year was the, you know, the talent procurement year. I think they started 13-9 last year, but, you know, that was not going to happen. And it wasn't like an act of sabotage, but Rick was going to make the trades and increase that, you know, that talent pool that they have. And again, get that, what are they, number 4 in the draft this year overall. This year is more about talent development. And, you know, they're still going to look to add pieces, I think, through the draft and possibly through trades. And there are some talented veterans on this team who they kind of have to make a decision about moving forward. Are they part of the picture, or are they going to be part of the picture via trade to add more talent? So, you know, I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it's more on the side of talent development this year and seeing both at the major leagues and the minor leagues what they have and where they may have to fill in as they get closer to completing the rebuild.
Yeah, talking about first-round picks, it seems like so long ago, but Carson Fulmer was a first-round pick for the White Sox and highly touted out of college at that, to the point where a lot of people thought that, you know, that he was going to be a star. And now it seems like he's just barely making the starting rotation, and it may even be last call for Carson Fulmer. My question, Scott, is what's happened to him?
Well, I think you're gonna get a look and see what he has this year. You know, it's interesting because he did not have good numbers in spring training, and, you know, until his last start didn't pitch very well. But it seems to me, just from hearing and seeing things that the Sox pretty much had him targeted as the number five starter, kind of come hell or high water there. So he's going to get a chance. I don't think it's going to be, you know, he starts against Toronto and then I guess Detroit after whatever, another, he gets a home start after that. I don't think it's going to be like, you know, if he struggles in two starts, they're immediately sending him down and putting Santiago in the rotation. So he's going to get a chance. And, you know, he pitched a little better at the end of last year. I think it's just kind of, you know, controlling the tempo of his delivery and just getting everything to work for him. I don't think they've given up on Carson yet. I think they're trying to figure out where Carson fits. Maybe it won't be, you know, as part of the rotation. I've seen some people speculate that he could be a closer for a, you know, for a championship caliber team. So, you know, hey, that's a pretty good addition, too, to have on there. But they're so pitching deep from the major leagues, you know, throughout that system that that's why it's a development thing right now. It's a development year. You know, this is Carson Fulmer's chance, but in the same sense, he's got to take advantage of that chance this year. And again, I don't think he's done if he struggles this year, but I do think that, you know, it certainly does make a difference moving forward for him.
What when you look at Mankata and you wrote about, you know, what the changes he made, or at least the cut down on the swinging bad pitches and the number of strikeouts by the end of spring training, you write that he's going to still strike out a fair amount of times, but when he's sitting there, assuming he's going to keep the top spot in the lineup for the long term, what do you expect from him, and what changes has he made, if any, to be have a little bit more plate discipline?
Well, I think his plate discipline was pretty decent last year. He was able, I mean, I know he struck out a decent amount, but or quite a bit actually. But I mean, he was able to work a count. I mean, people still talk about the first at bat where fans were cheering foul balls that he hit and cheering pitches that he took to get, you know, an 0-2 count back to a full count. So he's got a good eye up there. And I think it's just, for him, it's a question of experience. You know, I think last year, it's the same thing that Lucas Giolito went through originally with the Nationals and then a little bit in the Sox system, where it's a good thing to be the number one prospect in MLB Pipeline or Baseball America or whatever, but it's also got a little pressure. And then when you start struggling, people start, you know, the whispers say, well, maybe he's not that good. Maybe he's not a number one guy. Maybe he's just kind of a player. And I think Giolito was able to finally put that, along with fixing some mechanics issues last year, Giolito was able to put that behind him and now is on stable footing. And I think Moncada, who always had a good, even keel demeanor, is also in that same boat. So I think last year was, you kind of just chalk it up to experience. He had, what, like 231 plate appearances. And this is a year, again, it's not going to be end all and be all, but you're going to get a much better read on what Moncada does, because he's the guy. He's going to be out there pretty much every day, 600 plate appearances, and you're going to get to see what he really has. And I think it's, you know, it's a very wide array of tools for him at the top of the White Sox order.
And to that end of guys struggling maybe right out of the box, I think even Chris Bryant struck out three or four times in his first game, and I think it was against James Shields, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right.
And
fake news.
Yeah, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier. I get that James Shields at 36 is not part of the core of this team, but I suppose life is good for James Shields, that he's making the money that he's making. He knows he's not part of anything, but he could kind of just do his thing and then possibly end up on a contender at some point during the end of the season, help himself, and maybe even help the White Sox.
But I would argue that he is part of something, because he is really, you know, highly thought of in that clubhouse. And I you know, I've argued this before on other interviews and other just talking to people casually, that people don't like the mentor word in this day of so much analytics and so many good stats to qualify things by. You know, we have obviously StatCast in our company, but he really does help both the pitchers and the hitters on that team. And players were talking about that yesterday, just sitting around at dinner and hearing him talk about the old days. The guy's 36 and he's talking about the old days. And, you know, how just, and for hitters, he talks about how pitchers set them up. For pitchers, he talks about, you know, how to go about each at bat. And I remember Dylan Covey last year, who, you know, struggled pretty strongly in his first foray into the major leagues, and how much James Shields just tried to be a sounding board after every start, you know, trying to keep things in perspective. So I don't know what his future is going to be past this year, but I think the next few months, but I think he is a pretty solid asset beyond the mound for the White Sox right now.
And that newly discovered late last season arm slot, is that sustainable? Is that going to make him a different pitcher?
Well, we'll see. You know, I mean, he talked yesterday about, you know, he feels good with his durability, that he's been on the disabled list one time in his whole career. But he did kind of joke that if you take a hammer and swing it 45,000 times, obviously when you swing it the 45,000 and first, it's not going to feel as good as the first time, you know. So But in the same sense, he did say he felt his arm felt good. You know, he liked what he did in spring training. He feels in a good spot, so we'll see what he has today against one of his old teams. This is, what, eighth opening day start, and he's done it for four teams now, White Sox, Royals, Padres, and, you know, in his heyday, the Rays.
We'll let you go, Scott. Cleveland, is this simply their division, or do you expect a team like the Twins to push them at all?
I think the Twins should be, you know, it's funny, it seems like the Twins play well or have the big seasons when people don't expect as much from them, and people are expecting a little bit from them this year.
Right.
But I do think they've done a nice job of, you know, kind of strengthening the staff and strengthening the team overall. I think there's, you know, about six or seven teams in the American League that look above the rest, and I think everything else is pretty much up for grabs, which is another reason why I think, you know, if the White Sox get some development from these younger guys and get, you know, get steady play from the veterans, they could be, as Mark said, you know, a 500 sort of team.
Hey, Scott, how's your back, man?
It's better. It's better. Okay. I'm back in Kansas City. It's good enough to go. I appreciate everyone's concern, and herniated discs are not fun, but
oh,
hey, everyone's got something, right? So it's I'm ready to go and looking forward to opening day and looking forward to Saturday night too.
Yeah, real quick, five reasons why Loyola will beat Michigan. Go.
Hey, listen, I covered Loyola a little bit in another lifetime profession. I really enjoy the story. I think overlooked in Loyola, you know, the Cinderella thing and everything else, is they're a really good basketball team. But I think Michigan's going to win on Saturday night.
Terrific. Scott, take care. And thanks for picking up the phone this morning. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Take care, guys.
He's Scott Merkin. And since he gave us a little rundown on the Loyola of Chicago team.
Is Scott a Marlboro guy or a Winston guy?
We could tell you the scores. College basketball coverage through Monday's championship game is brought to you by Subway. New signature wraps now at Subway restaurants. And, of course, Peoria Matt texting in there. Everyone taking a shot. That's what we do here at The Score. You got Grody sitting in for Molly. Molly and Hanley on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
That's Chris Bryant talking about teammate Kyle Schwarber, the new and improved Kyle Schwarber, certainly the reconditioned Kyle Schwarber, and a lot of people making light. I guess Anthony Rizzo had one of his fundraisers in the offseason and had stand-up comedians and said, you know, when you look like Schwarber of last year, you're Schwarbs. You're the frat guy. You have nicknames. You're Babe Schwarbs and, you know, Schwarb bombs. And then when you get down to 180 pounds, you're just Kyle.
Right. Well, he's one of those guys in life, and maybe you know somebody like this, who the extra weight actually looks good on. Like there are some people who wear extra weight well, it does mean no good whatsoever, but somebody like Schwarber, it was befitting. It looked right. So, you know, it's always possible he gets it back, but none of that matters. I mean, the reason that Kyle Schwarber hits well and that he hits the ball so far is that electric bat speed through the zone. That's the key to Kyle Schwarber. You know, the weight loss, the weight gain, anything, none of it matters at all. One thing that I've realized, Brian, throughout the course of this morning, I said earlier that CJ Edwards to me is the most important player on the Cubs this year. I think the most interesting guy, just after talking to Gordon Whitmire and some of our other Cubs people today, is Ian Happ.
Yeah.
And not just because he's leading off, but also because of the fact that it looks that he's going to get a chance, because he is a switch hitter, to play that position every single day and not have that platoon necessarily with Albert Almora Jr.
But as Joe O pointed out during the 5-on-5, what it was 150-plus lineups that Joe went through last year. Joe being Joe, I mean, if Happ continues to do what he did in spring with the bat, there's going to be no reason to tinker with it. And I did like what Gordon said, that the approach isn't making it a absolute certainty that Ian Happ's got this job. I mean, like they did with Schwarber, almost stubborn to a fault last year, even when it wasn't working out. You know, we know, you know, we had a plan, and the plan, just because the plan didn't work doesn't mean it wasn't a good plan.
Right.
But, you know, Happ certainly did what they asked him to do in the offseason as well, and dropped some weight, get in better shape, worked on his defense in his center field to the point where I don't expect to see him at second base, really.
No.
But, you know, the kid, you know him. I saw Kelly Kroll did a feature at NBC Sports Chicago and went out and played some golf with him. And first time I really saw him outside of the baseball world, and the kid is pretty confident, got a dry sense of humor.
Yep.
And
smart. He's
smart,
cerebral
yeah.
kid.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like anything overwhelms him.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I think the other, you know, vulnerable spot this year, believe it or not. And we've seen him come out of a lot of games in certain situations as Jason Hayward, where if it continues to go like it has gone for Jason Hayward, you might see more Albert Almora Jr. in that right field spot, or even a possible platoon with those guys, or even if Schwarber struggles. So instead of thinking Albert Almora Jr., a platoon Ian Happ, I would think the corner outfield positions, and that's going to be really interesting to watch.
Always. Where are you at with Jason Hayward when it comes? Are you expecting a better year, or is this a guy, you know, he is what he is now, and no matter how much he tries to do change in the offseason and Chili Davis, or, you know, you can roll in a new a batting coach every year. He still has 6 years left on that deal, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm afraid he is what he is at this point. I mean, because we've seen two full years of it, and it's almost like a Yips version on offense, like what defensive guys go through, where they had something and then inexplicably lost it. And I still don't know what's happened. And I realize that, you know, a lot of his numbers were embedded with some of the things he did with on-base percentage and all that kind of stuff. Like, home runs were not supposed to necessarily be a part of his repertoire when he came to the Cubs.
But when you look at a guy that size, you would think that, you know, 12 home runs won't get it done.
Well,
right?
The problem with him was even his outs were horrible. I know that sounds ridiculous, but there was times when you just needed to get a ball up in the air.
Yep.
And how many times did we see him roll out to second base or a broken bat hit over the or towards shortstop? And it is maddening when you see a guy like that, and knowing what he did in the past before he came to the Cubs. So, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe Chili Davis, maybe that is part of the reason. Maybe you have this guy under contract as long as you do, and that maybe it's important to the Cubs that you get this guy right, and that could have had something to do with the change from John Mailey to Chili Davis this year. So obviously you hope that he can turn it around, but if you're asking me yes or no at this point, I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I think most people would. I mean, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you err on that side? Because the eye test tells you, look, you give him all the credit in the world. It wasn't like he, after the World Series, just decided to go home, not do anything, and hope things changed. He went down to Mesa and worked as quickly as he could and for as long as he could, and just didn't appreciably change.
And he's a great outfielder, that does help, and that should keep him in the lineup a lot of the time. And the opportunity cost, unfortunately, in the case of Jason Hayward, is the batting. But he will help you win games in the outfield as well.
One of our texters pointed out, and we just looked it up. In fact, Rusty Staub did pass away today, 73 on opening day. So it's sad to lose one of the Giants. All I know is the Grand Orange was a Cub killer.
Ugh, I hated him.
I know.
I really hated him.
Ed Cranepool and guys like that who couldn't bat a lick against other teams seemed to always be able to tee it up pretty well at Wrigley Field in particular. But
What I hated about him? He choked up like almost to the top of the bat.
Yeah. Here's this big guy with this. Yeah.
Like, cut that out, you goofy little. And he looked like he was 57. Now, I was, you know, like 11, so everybody looked like they were 57 to me. That was over 30. But yeah, I hated that guy. But I'm sorry that we've lost.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I like the guy.
I hated him.
I don't want you to run my old bit, but thanks a lot.
Is there a certain limit, though? Like, I mean, like, until you start poking fun at a dead guy?
Apparently not.
Am I making fun of him? I didn't like him.
An hour.
After an hour?
No, I mean, he didn't even wait for the hour, I don't believe, I think.
You should have seen how much he choked up on the bat, Dustin. It was annoying.
And I remembered him as a Met. I didn't remember as an Expo, but I remember.
He was a big guy with a little guy's stance.
Yeah.
And unnecessary. Well, maybe it was necessary at that point, but he would just kind of stick his bat out and get these little annoying blue pits against the Cubs. So.
Grody, you sound like Les talking about Charles Martin.
I don't want Charles Martin is a bad guy. I was happy he died.
What he did to Jim McMahon?
He's D-E-D
dead.
Bury him in the mustard and relish.
All right. Yeah, Charles Martin. Wow. Public Enemy 1. For all you youngsters out there, he once slammed Jim McMahon.
He used it like a pile driver.
Yeah, he
like
did.
Putting a post in
imagine
the turf.
Imagine what that towel would go for, right?
Like, oh, yeah, you grabbed it, yeah.
Could you imagine? And then the folks over at the Harry Carey restaurant would pulverize it and put it in the sauce or something, yes. Right?
Hey, how's the... Yeah.
Charles Martin towel.
Wow.
Sauce, carbonara.
Yeah. Anyone out there ever taste that sauce? It was like $100 a spoonful or whatever. And is the Jim McMahon Renegade show still in Vegas? Is that still selling out there at the, was it Caesars?
No, but you know what I am looking forward to if it still exists, and maybe somebody could call us if they had it. Did you ever have, well, no, you didn't have it, Grody. The John Lester mitt soaked in vodka.
Oh, the vodka. The vodka over here, right? Whatever there's trendy
a
hotel was, yeah.
Yeah, and part of the proceeds. Lester game-worn mitt
inside.
Sitting in this big vat of vodka.
Right. Wow. And, like, and you can sip
cocktail.
The vodka?
Yeah, you have the cocktail.
Hey, I'm always up for a relapse.
Okay. You said it. I was treading lightly.
I'm just making it easy
Speaking
for
of
you.
Untreading lightly yeah. this morning, there's yeah. Mark Grody.
I'm down. It's opening day.
On that note.
Yeah. I got a tall boy in my future. Cut heavy.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
And we love to get a chance to talk to Mike Florio each and every week. And boy, this week more so than ever. Good morning, Mike.
How are you guys?
Doing well. Man, can you sort out the doings going on in Orlando that wrapped up yesterday? I mean, I love your reporting to yesterday and today that the PA didn't see this coming and they weren't consulted about the crown, you know, leading with the helmet rule, and that there's only 10 instances where they would have been targeting last year in throughout all the NFL, and yet unanimously passed, and here we go.
Well, and let's keep this in mind. USA Today said that there were fewer than 10 plays that would have been flagged. The league office told us that's incorrect. And Rich McKay, the chairman of the competition committee, says that this will be a significant change to the sport. I'm concerned about this on a variety of levels. Primarily, look, there's typically transparency when the NFL unveils its potential new rules. Last week, there were 10 proposals from the competition committee. Well, this was proposal number 11 that no one knew about. And regardless of the merit, and we can talk merit separately, the fact that this thing was kind of slipped through the five hole, it was hidden. We didn't know anything about it. There was no opportunity for a meaningful debate. It's almost like, let's get the coaches, let's get the owners in the room, let's give them our version of what needs to happen before they ever have a chance to hear other voices that may be reasonable dissenting voices as to what the unintended consequences of taking this play out of the game will be. And beyond that, now I'm troubled by the fact that it was all handled in a very secretive fashion. Beyond that, I don't know what the rule is. I don't know how it's going to be enforced. I don't know how prevalent it's going to be. And when you consider how reflexive and instinctive it is for a guy to protect himself by dipping his head, when are they going to have the appropriate confidence they need to know when they throw that flag, they're throwing it at the right time? And if you have an arbitrary application of this rule at a time when gambling is about to become legalized, you're setting the stage for people to say, now the fix is in, and this is the easy way to fix the outcome of the game. You throw the flag more for the team that you want to lose for doing what all players are going to continue to do, which is dip their helmet at the point of impact.
So then is the answer that they slipped this rule in, as you said, put it at number 11 because they knew the players wouldn't like it, and they just thought, okay, let's put this in there parenthetically?
I think it's a combination of the players not liking it, the media not liking it, the fans not liking it. I think they wanted to get the owners to vote on this before they realized what they were doing, before they could hear people like us, before they could hear people like Richard Sherman, before they could hear the pushback as to what this will do. And I've said for years now that the NFL's biggest risk when it comes to making the game safer is that if it ever changes how the game looks and feels in a very fundamental way, that opens the door for the old school football league where one of these guys that doesn't successfully buy the Panthers takes his $2.5 billion and decides, you know what, we're going to play football the way it used to be played, and everybody knows the risks, and the players want to do it, and the fans want to consume it. And I don't know that this is the one. This is the first time I've thought they're getting close to an accumulation of changes that invites someone to say, hey, we'll just play football like we played it in the 80s and wait and see what happens next. The over-under for getting rid of the kickoff, in my mind, is 2.5 years. The over-under for getting rid of the three-point stance is 5.5 years. Wow. At what point do people say, what's the over-under for a football league that plays football the way that we want it to be played?
If you get rid of the kickoffs, are you going to get rid of punts eventually too? And everyone just, you know, it's a fair catch. You have to fair catch it wherever it is on the field. Or, you know, if it kicks it out of bounds, then that's okay, but you can't return anything?
Here's the difference between the punt return and the kick return. With the kick return, you often have guys who are running at their opponent full speed.
Sure.
Building up maximum momentum and instinctively dipping their helmets when it's time to collide. That's how Kevin Everett, the Bills line tight end, suffered a serious injury 11 years ago and was almost paralyzed. The quick actions from the doctors helped preserve his ability to walk. But that's what they're concerned about. That's why they've been trying to de-emphasize the kickoff. And when they do get rid of the kickoff, and when they get rid of it, we're going to say, okay, what's a big deal? You've made it meaningless anyway. We're not going to complain the way we would have if they had just all out of the blue said, oh, by the way, the kickoff's gone. The only viable alternative, and this seed was planted by the commissioner in the Time magazine profile. Remember, he was on the cover, and it said the enforcer. In that article, he passed along an idea that Greg Schiano had given to him because Schiano was at Rutgers when the Eric LeGrand tragedy happened on a kick return. And you replace the kickoff with the team that would be kicking off getting the ball at its own 30 or 35 facing 4th and 15. Most cases, you're going to punt. If you're down late in a game, you're going to go for it. And if you want to do the simulation of a surprise onside kick, you do essentially a fake punt. And that's a way to preserve possession because you can't get rid of the kickoff and not give the team that just scored the ability to keep possession. Otherwise, these games are going to be over long before they otherwise would be or should be over.
Isn't this going to, and maybe I'm overthinking this, but isn't this going to cost players jobs too if that occurs? Could rosters be reduced if in essence you don't have special teams?
Well, not reduced, but reshaped. Right, that you would have less of a need for the classic special teamer. And this is one of the reasons why the injuries happen on kick return plays. Because on game day, when you take 53 and decide which 46 you're going to dress, some days you need that extra offensive lineman, and so you don't dress the guy who would be better on your kick return or kick coverage team, and you say to that reserve offensive lineman, all right, you're in position 5 on the kickoff team, and maybe that guy isn't suited to properly playing the position and understand how to protect himself, and he's susceptible to a greater injury. So that's part of this too. So maybe you do make it's more offense defense that special teams because becomes less relevant. You don't have to have that specialty. It's easier to be in your comfort zone of what you can and can't do. You'll still have the punt and the punt return and the field goal try and the extra point. But, yeah, you are going to necessarily make some jobs irrelevant in the NFL by getting rid of the kickoff. But you know what? They're trying to preserve football as a generation-to-generation endeavor. And I think this is all pushback to mom and dad not letting little Jimmy play football. They're trying to make the changes necessary to bring back youth football and to have that pipeline of players that will be available and ready to play professional football.
The Monday morning right after the Super Bowl, we came in here and said, we just saw the future of the process of the catch changing on Super Bowl Sunday and before they even got to a vote. And I think we talked with you that week about that in fact, those were the changes they were advocating. So do we at least have an idea now of how this is supposed to be called moving forward?
Yeah, but here's the thing. And I saw the suggestion from ESPN that they actually legislated on the fly, that they changed the catch rule on the fly. I think that gives the league office way too much credit. I don't think they'd be capable of pulling that off. I think what ultimately happened was Al Riveron, the senior VP of officiating, was told, you will apply the proper replay review standard. I said all season long, this isn't a catch rule issue. This is a replay review issue because Riveron was going frame by frame in ultra high def and dissecting what he saw versus determining whether or not the evidence of a mistake via the call on the field was clear enough to justify overturning it. So I think that they just simply applied the indisputable visual evidence standard the way that they should, not that they rewrote the rule. But yes, I think what this is all about, when you consider how the rule is now constructed, I think the primary goal is to insulate rulings on the field of a catch from being overturned by replay review. And I think the only time we will see reversals now is when the ruling on the field is that a guy didn't make a catch, but on replay review, we will see, well, you know what, he did get a third foot down, or he did reach or extend the ball before he was hit and lost possession of it. So I think that we're going to rarely see an Al Riveron decide to overturn a ruling on the field of a catch.
Yeah, we'll let you go, Mike, but as far as the other rule changes upcoming here with the NFL, there was no universal or unanimous way to approach the national anthem protests. You had very divisive stances taken by different owners. What is going to happen moving forward next season? Because it is impacting the game, pro or con, depending your their political stance. Yeah.
Here's the thing. they were at risk as of Sunday of having the anthem controversy take over again because there was a back and forth via the media of Bill O'Brien and Jets CEO Christopher Johnson, but that died down. I think what's going to happen, and look at what happened with this helmet rule, how it just can pop out of the blue whenever they want it to. I think what will occur on a Friday, late June, there's going to be a conference call, and the result of that conference call is going to be, you know what, the players are just going to stay in the locker room. I've seen the suggestion, well, you can choose to stay in the locker room, you can choose to come out. We saw what a mess that was for the Steelers when they played the Bears the week that this all hit the fan. I think that the only way out of this for the NFL is to turn the clock back to 2008 and quit using the players as props in this effort to wrap itself in the flag and just say, like all the major colleges, you're staying in the locker room. They'll take some heat for it initially, but once that's the rule, there's nothing for anyone to complain about because they're all in the locker room, and that's where they are, and that's where everyone is, and I think that's the only rule that makes sense. And I think it'll be a Friday, late June, when we're all on vacation, that this thing all of a sudden pops up as a new rule for 2018.
Mike, you're the best. Always appreciate it. Thanks,
guys.
We'll talk to you. Mike Florio, ProFootballTalk.com, NBC Sports. Right now, it's your chance to win $1,000 in cash, courtesy of The Score. The hour's keyword is key, K-E-Y. Text that keyword, K-E-Y, to 72881. Do it by the top of the hour, and you do it 72881, text word key. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win $1,000. Don't text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. You got Molly and Hanley on The Score.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.